This is Night Call, the first and only nationwide listener call-in show on vital issues. Tonight's subject, revolution for the hell of it. Tonight's guest, Yippie Abby Hoffman. Night Call is your program. Share your opinions and ideas with the rest of the country. Speak for yourself and ask your questions directly by calling Night Call in New York City from anywhere in North America. Here are Night Call's special phone numbers. From the East and Midwest, call collect at area code 212-749-3311. From the West at 212-749-4300. And from the New York area at 866-5010. Now from New York City, Night Call's host, Del Shields.
Good evening. Quote, "I am the revolution," unquote, announces Abby Hoffman, sometime poor hustler, civil rights worker, founder of the Yippies, and author of Revolution for the Hell of It. The way Abby Hoffman plays at the revolution game goes something like this, and again we quote, "Clarity, alas, is not one of our goals. Confusion is mightier than the sword. We cry, no one understands us, while at the same time, winking out of the corner of our eye, recognizing that if the straight world understood all this, it would render us impotent because understanding is the first step to control, and control is the secret to our extension. This reluctance to define ourselves gives us glorious freedom," unquote. In short, this leader of the Yippies says words and names are meaningless, so he calls himself simply free. And that kind of sums up the philosophy of Abby Hoffman in his words. But it still leaves me with a lot of unanswered questions. Is Abby Hoffman a colossal put-on, or is he trying to tell us something very important? And just how does a 24-year-old, intelligent, well-educated man from a well-to-do home end up talking about revolution for the hell of it and showing a willingness to get his head bashed in? Now, I realize there are a lot of people who just as soon dismiss Abby Hoffman as some kind of nut and let it go at that. But I'm not willing to do that. I want to know more about the whole thing, and certainly hope that you do, too. I want to know just why Abby Hoffman is a kind of hero, or maybe I should say anti-hero, to a whole lot of the younger generation. And I want to know what that says about the ability of those past the age of 30, which includes us, to get into communication with the young. Now, Abby Hoffman is my guest tonight, and he's calling in from New York City, so perhaps we can find who he is and what he's talking about. And I also want to invite you, the Night Call listeners, to call in with your questions and opinions about Abby Hoffman and the Yippies. Abby, good evening, or should I say Mr. Free?
No. Gosh, I'm blushing.
Thank you.
You can't blush on radio.
Well, thank you for being with us this evening. Abby, are the Yippies for real? That's our first question of the night, and then we want to talk to you a bit about Chicago and also get into the black element as well. Are the Yippies for real?
Well, I think that there's a... It's not a kind of organization where people, like, send in, you know, $5, $10 and become a member and then go to various little meetings around the country and talk about what they're going to do and then end up not doing anything. Well, it's a slogan, you know, yippee, and it has an exclamation point, and that element of it was a put-on. It was a slogan. People think there are such things as yippies or hippies or straights or squares or anything. They're just people, and it was it's sort of an exercise in people coming to terms with themselves. The way we ran it, we just programmed it like a myth, not like a carefully defined object that says, well, you got to do this and you got to do such and such and then you're a yippie. We had an office here before we went to Chicago. We let anybody talk on the phone. They just made it up what it was. We had reporters interviewing each other, and it didn't matter because we kind of recognized that the role of media is distortion, that you can't talk about truth in terms of television, you know, news flashes. You have to talk in terms of images, and the images go out, and the images are sort of fun-loving weird freaks that are against the existing order and willing to use any means necessary. to preserve their alternative culture. You see, we sort of dismissed America as like a viable form of government and of people relating to each other, and have rejected most of the values that are coming down these days, and are off developing a new society. And it was that society that we brought to Chicago. And you see the kind of conflict you get in when you like go to a place where the other society is doing their thing.
Well, was Chicago a real thing, or was this a put-on, or as we said in the opening, that you didn't want to play it straight, because had you played it straight, then you might have been rendered impotent. But what was the beginning of Chicago? Why did you go? What did you hope to accomplish?
Well, I guess we started working on it about 6 months before, and it was good old LBJ in the Vietnam War going, you know, escalating higher and higher, and it looked like he was coming back in, and it started out with a certain form, and the form kept changing because in that 6 months before the convention, things changed quite rapidly, and our thing had to change accordingly. We had planned for a festival of life in opposition to what we considered to be the convention of death. And they were going to hold their convention amid the slaughterhouses of Chicago, which is the hog capital of the world. And we were going to hold ours in Lincoln Park, which is about 10 miles away. And we were going to have free stores and seminars and problems that we face, like, you know, in this alternative culture, how are we going to live free? And music, dancing, Yippie Olympics, all that kind of stuff, and sort of do a whole satire on the convention. Well, permits got sort of bogged down. They stalled for about 4 months, and finally they didn't issue us any. And, of course, it was relevant to our thing that we'd be allowed to sleep in the park at night. We had no place to sleep. And over one simple ordinance, city ordinance, the whole battle really erupted. And it's kind of good, because that's what the fight's about. I mean, the parks belong to the people, the streets belong to the people. They should be free. And we felt we had a right to do our thing as much as the Democrats had a right to build barbed wire fences and bring in helicopters with machine guns and all that extra heavy hardware. We had a right to, like, come there and make love on the grass, do whatever we wanted. And somehow the police just busted that all up. So then it became a situation where we were at war. And every night, for a solid week, we would go to war. It was nothing different than we face right here in the Lower East Side, New York, or long-haired people, or blacks, or Puerto Ricans face all around the country. I mean, people were really shocked. Wow, police brutality. Look at that. Look at those pictures on TV. I don't believe it. So they took all these polls, and people said, hey, TV slanted it. That's not real. That's not the way it is. I mean, we've seen NYPD. We've seen Dragnet. We see the FBI every Sunday night. They're nice guys. But they're not. I mean, we brought to Chicago the real world as we see it every day.
Let's go back to the beginning for just a moment. You referred to the Democratic Convention as one that was going to be a convention of death. Now, define that for us.
They're all old men, you know, with old ideas, and I don't think they know what to do with the whole thing. You know, I don't think they think in terms of, like, freeing people from work, you know, and having machines do the work, and allowing people more control over their lives, so, say, women, you know, can get abortions if they feel it's necessary, young people can smoke pot if they like it, you know, and people have a right to take, you know, more matters into their own hands, like they are in Ocean Hill, Brownsville, or we do on the Lower East Side, and run our lives the way we see fit. I mean, there are 200 million people in this country, and there's no one way for everybody, and there's going to have to be a lot of decentralization of power, and a lot of young people are coming up. They're just not taking the old hypocritical stuff, you know. LBJ comes on the tube right after Martin Luther King is killed and says, we ought to be non-violent in his memory. Well, what does he mean? You know, he doesn't mean sit-ins in the Mekong Delta. He means that everybody ought to get off the street and stop complaining and get in the house.
Well, did you view your attempt at confrontation with the Democratic Convention there as an attempt to try to change the structure, change the policies, or to make your presence felt as a constructive Or would you call it constructive a voice of opposition? Exactly what did you want to do?
Words like serious and all those words are words that, and success, you know, that they're... Our culture's kind of shot all those words. You know, we can't talk, can't even talk about revolution, you know, without basing it totally in action, because, you know, Dash is a revolution in soap detergent, you know, and businessmen are serious, movie producers are serious, everybody's serious but the yippies. We're not serious at all, that's right. We're not success-oriented, we're none of those things, because we reject those values and those institutions that are being forced upon us. We're not going to live in an inhumane, brutal society that's based upon getting more money, getting ahead. We're not going to do that. And we don't think that that system can be changed by working within the standard political structure of this country. So we were saying, hey, come on, delegates. Come on, you kids that went to come here for McCarthy. You're going to get kicked out of that hall. Come on up to the park and turn on and... you know, find a girl and sit around and we'll talk about what we got to do and we'll listen to the music and we'll talk about building a new world because this old one's dead.
What would have happened had you been allowed to go into the park and do your thing freely and with your own control and no problem?
Well, I don't know. That's kind of a theoretical question now. Something would have happened. Would have happened maybe differently. Maybe would have been the same.
Would you have advocated...
You see, we nominated a pig for president. The pig's our leader. And the pigs, the cops, they, on those difficult situations, they always take away your decision, see? We can't say what we would have done in the park because the police drove us out every night.
Could we become involved in conjecture for just a moment? If you had been allowed to have just a big party out there in the park, and if the television cameras and the radio... microphones had not been available. Just looking at the group and saying, well, these are a group of young people coming into Chicago and they want to have a party and let them have the party. What do you think possibly would have happened?
Well, we've had those kind of sort of being things in Central Park. We've had up to 50, 60,000 people on Easter. And we were saying that all that energy, you know, it was like a hippie phenomenon. And people were like pulling off to the country and like having beans and saying, you got to drop out, you got to drop out totally. We were like saying, yeah, that's great, that's a great message. You really have to like get into your own head and figure out what you want and you have to pull apart from this society and resist and like get out of the draft and get out all those things. But what are you going to do next? And then when you decide to do something next, when you decide to build that community, you find very quickly that the police and the authorities in this country are going to smash it. You know, we have, for example, communes on the Lower East Side, crash pads that young kids come down and they stay there. They stay there free. They're like lost souls, you know. They run away from their parents left and right, and they come in the Lower East Side, and we try to take care of them, even though we're technically contributing to the delinquency of minors. We're breaking the law just by helping kids who are on the street, helping them have a place to stay and things like that. And we have police that would crash into our crash pads and bus kids. They're, God, I mean, I have friends that have been traveling around the country just because they have long hair. They're picked up and they're thrown in a police station, given a haircut and thrown out. And, like head shops that are just smashed and underground papers that are being closed down left and right because of censorship, some kind of, you know, screwy obscenity laws. And, I mean, I've had 31 arrests. And,
You've been arrested 31 times?
Yeah, I just got 15 days out of Chicago and 30 days for wearing a shirt flag to HUAC and a couple other things. Yeah, and I worked a lot in the South. But see, working in the civil rights movement was like a different thing for whites, you know. We're off on a mission, we're going to, like, help somebody else with their problem. And then, of course, when black power came in, which is like, you know, which we view as like a, you know, that's a correct position for blacks. Right, they have the right to determine their own destiny. And then we sort of broke away and said, well, now what do we do? And we said, wow, we build our own community right here with our own values. And if we have to fight to keep it, we fight.
Now, I want to ask you one question just before we go to station identification. You mentioned that in Central Park you had 50 to 60,000 people at a bin. Was there a problem at the time? Were you able to do this legally? Was the police on hand? Did you disrupt?
No, the police I guess the event before that was that's in people's minds was the time we went to Grand Central Station to celebrate the coming of spring at midnight. We had about 5,000-6,000 people, and the police just waded in without any warning and started to club people like wild because a few kids decided to rip down the hands of a clock. And I think that in itself, I got clubbed unconscious, and a kid came to help me, and two police threw him through a glass window and broke both his hands. And everybody in the establishment, you see, was very upset about the hands on this clock, but not about this kid's hands and not about what happened to us there. It shows that, like, we're concerned with, like, the human values, and they're concerned with property. Property's meaningless. I mean, it's just nothing. It's got no
life.
This
may sound like an elementary question, but why did the clock have to be destroyed? Why did you have to remove the clock?
I don't know. What kids see, people could do whatever they wanted. I don't know. Maybe it was an ugly clock. They painted signs on it, made it pretty. I don't know. But the point is, so what? You know, I mean, for that, like, $10 worth of repair, you know, a damage, are they going to crack the skulls of 200 people? And the answer to that was yes. And the city got very uptight about that. And we said, hey, look, we're not stopping. We're not turning back. We're going to Central Park, and we'll have 10 times this number. Now, what are you going to do about it? And they quite wisely, you know, got very shook and said, we'll leave you alone. Just stay there.
Well,
we had a great time.
If you're talking about being able to do your own thing, which I'm interpreting as freedom, doesn't freedom imply responsibility?
Well, people carry that inside of them. See, again, we're caught in a word thing. A responsibility you always have to ask to what?
All right, hold that.
To my brothers and
sisters. Abby, just hold that till we come back after station identification.
Sure.
This is the Night Call Network. We'll return after station identification.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Abby Hoffman after station identification.
If you left school and you're between 16 and 22, Job Corps wants to give you a chance to start again. A chance to learn the skills that can help you get a good job. Maybe as an auto mechanic, an office worker, a welder, just about anything. And while you're learning, you'll be living at a Job Corps center. You'll get free medical and dental care, clean clothes, your own bed to sleep in, and 3 square meals a day. Job Corps will even pay you while you're learning. See your state employment office. Or write Job Corps, Washington, D.C. Job Corps will give you a chance. Just for once, give yourself a chance.
Ask your own questions direct. Speak for yourself, collect from anywhere in North America to guest Yippie Abby Hoffman about the Yippie style of revolution. Call Night Call Collect from the East and Midwest on area code 212-749-3311. From the West on area code 212-749-4300. And from the New York area on 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
And we return to our guest, Abby Hoffman. And just before station identification, we were asking Abby about a definition of doesn't freedom imply responsibility? And we'll pass it over to you again, Abby.
Yeah, well, responsibility to what? See, probably after I get through with this show, the phone will ring and one of my brothers will be in jail. I mean, it happens just about every night. And you know, some of us will have to go down and bail them out. We feel a responsibility to the members of our community, and certainly feel no responsibility or no respect for the institutions of values that held by the people in power in this country. In fact, quite the opposite. We feel a responsibility to destroy those institutions.
And why do you feel that responsibility?
Well, because I feel that they're interfering with my freedom, and they're interfering with a lot of people's freedom. Other people's freedom. You know, we have 10 million hungry people in this country. This country owns 85% of Brazil. This country owns 60% of Canada. This is the richest country in the world, and there are people starving and hungry all over the world. They feel a necessity to go to Vietnam and force their values and institutions down those people's throat. Well, I reject that. I reject that concept, and I think that the people in power have taken this country down the wrong road. I'm not anti, you know, the original values of this country, the original revolution. In fact, I feel that our birthright's been stolen. I feel close to them. My next book's going to be about the Battle of Lexington and Concord. I was born right near that bridge, and I feel close to those values. I feel close to Jefferson saying that we need a revolution every 10 years. But somehow this government's become so big with so much power, and that the business corporations have become so big and so inhuman that we feel we have to go after them. Now people always say, hey, you got a bomb, you know, when you say that. Well, maybe not. I mean, there are a lot of ways. You see, we were in Chicago, the whole world was watching, and what we were saying is, you know, it isn't all smooth, this whole what they call a democratic process in this country. It isn't that way at all. They need troops, they need barbed wire, they need helicopters. And they're beating up their young. And that image got projected around the world, and that was very effective, that action. And we went to the stock exchange and threw out money. And you see, that says something. It's our actions are based on a lot of theater concepts and involving people in a theatrical way rather than a debate on the issues, you know. You can't go on and give a long on TV, you know, and rap out a long thing about the evils of capitalism. You just go down to Wall Street and throw out the money, and everybody gets a point.
If you were able to change or to make or to effect changes in the country and in the society and in the establishment, what would you do?
Well, you asking for a strategy for change or what we're going to do afterwards?
No, I'm asking for the answers. If we look at the establishment, if we look at the establishment today and we say that the establishment is not doing what we feel it should do, if the people in government are not living up to the Constitution, if we feel that government has become so large and so broad that it does interfere with the individual rights of the citizens. All right, now Abby Hoffman comes along and says, look, we've got to change that. Now, what would you change?
Well, where do you want to start? You have to, like, pick out an issue. You want to destroy the schools? We'll start with that. We could talk about schools because a lot of the battles will now shift from like a national focus because Nixon's sort of he's not LBJ running a ranch, you know. He's going to run a corporation very smooth and slick. And the battle is going to shift to the universities where young people are struggling for more control over their own lives, more say in what's going on. And we look at those universities and we find, like a place like MIT where I was a few weeks ago, where the kids were all concerned about what they were going to do in their future life, and they didn't like being there. And you find out that they have $100 million in defense spending contracts at MIT. And
what do you mean they don't like being there?
They don't like being put through a treadmill and then given certain skills that they, by definition, have to run right in and support this establishment. They don't like becoming the technicians to keep up a system which they don't think is doing too well.
Then they're not agreeing with the kind of education that they're getting.
That's, yeah, not only the kind of education, but a lot that's involved in education is the right of people to make decisions. You see, in working out problems for themselves, in having a say in things. That's an educational experience, better than if somebody comes along and says, well, this is how you do it, this is how we always did it, you know. I mean, education is from the bottom up, it's a tool whereby you take young people and try to fit them into the established order. And people say there's propaganda in other countries. In other countries, they call it propaganda and indoctrination. Here, they call it education. But it's the same, you know.
Abby, I've got to start taking some calls, and I spent this much time with you because I felt that it was necessary for us to kind of explore as much as possible.
Let me just say what our future thing will look like.
Okay.
Well, we're concerned with a free society. We think that the machines and the technology and the media that we have available in this country allow for us to really provide pretty much the basic essentials that people need for free, like medicine for free, shelter for free, telephones for free, food for free, clothes for free, that we could provide these free. And we could just do it. I mean, part of my book is How to Live Free in New York, where you can get, like, fish and food and get on the subway free, sneak on, you know.
Abby, we'll begin taking some phone calls, and we'll take our first call of the evening from Stamford, Connecticut. Mr. Davidson is hearing Night Call over WSTC. Mr. Davidson?
Stamford.
Yes, Mr. Free,
Mr. Free?
Well,
you can just call me Abby, huh?
Yes, sir. No, I wanted to know, why did you decide to form the Yippies?
Why did we decide to form the Yippies?
Why did you decide to get a group of kids and form the Yippies?
I can just barely hear her.
Well, is this better?
Yes, the question is, why did you decide to form the Yippies?
Right, Yippies. Yes. Well, first we decided that we were going to go to Chicago. And we had an idea of what we were going to do in a park and how it was going to look and what kind of statements we were going to project about our feelings about the Democratic Party and political process in general. And, you know, with no money and no organization, we decided to use the media as a tool for organizing. And we started to look around and say, hey, what's this thing called hippie? I mean, we're all called hippies, and how did that happen? We don't call each other hippies. You know, we never considered ourselves hippies. So we said, gee, that's a media-created myth. There are no hippies. They just created it. Well, what would happen if we just changed the H to a Y and made it Yippies? And people said, well, what's a Yippie? They said, oh, that's somebody that's going to Chicago during the Democratic Convention. They said, well, oh, yeah, right. And it was just an attempt to use certain kinds of theories that came out of Marshall McLuhan and the use of television. And it's just what Mayor Daley said, I guess. Yeah, we use the media. It was just a media-created myth. And as a result, people got the message. Young people got the message and came to Chicago.
In effect, there is no organization of Yippies as we look at more formally structured organizations? Is Yippie just a spiritual term, or is it just an advertising cliche? Is it just a description
of... That will probably die out I would certainly say by after next summer. It's it was meant that way. I mean, we don't believe in organizing in the traditional methods. We believe in organizing around actions. And that was it. Our action was Chicago, and we created that whole thing just to sort of take us to Chicago. And it worked. Now, there are other forms. We're not questioning that kind of organization. Does that stick? You know, do young people really get the message that they change their lives? We don't know. Winter's a time when you sort of rethink these things. People think that, like, mass movements like SDS and the Yippies and New Left are a thing of the past. They've served their purpose, that there won't be tremendous national demonstrations like Chicago anymore, that people will move into what we call affinity groups or gangs. They'll just get a group of 10 to 20 friends and go off and live, whether in the city or in the country, and do their thing independently.
Mr. Davidson, thank you for calling, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm still concerned about freedom and going back to the Grand Central Station program, the fact of taking hands off the clock, was it not possible to just have a gathering there to do your thing without the removal or destruction of any property?
Well, I would only only be guessing at the reasons for people taking hands off the clock, see, since I didn't do that particular act. And I'm not a spokesman for anybody, really, except myself. And,
well, can we look at...
I can only guess about that.
Can we look at the situation this way? Grand Central Station at 12 midnight, I don't know what evening it was, but I don't think that they would have the necessary people on hand to control a crowd or to stand by to be responsible.
Well, they had about 600 cops that night. They knew we were coming.
They knew you were coming?
Oh, yeah.
Right. So you brought in 5,000 people to Grand Central Station at 12 midnight. Now, isn't this a bit unusual?
Well, I wouldn't say that we're going about it in the usual manner. The usual manner, as far as we're concerned, didn't work.
Well, wouldn't this shock people, or wouldn't people be caught unprepared for 4,000, for 5,000 youngsters to...
A lot of the commuters sort of dug it. They were there, and they got in. There were balloons flying around, and everybody was passing out candy and stuff, and we had a lot of music and guitars going.
At 12 midnight?
Yeah, that's right.
Abby, we'll come back to you right after station identification. Our conversation tonight on Night Call, Revolution for the Hell of It. Our guest is Yippie Abby Hoffman. We'll return after station identification.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Abby Hoffman after station identification. Next week on Night Call, Del Shields with his guest, a nationally known labor strike mediator who comments on the effectiveness of arbitration, the former governor of Ohio on the value of capital punishment, the editor of the black nationalist magazine, The Liberator, the assistant director of the Center for the Study of the Prevention of Suicides, and a college president from California who asks, are students destroying our universities? Monday, Del Shields' guest is perhaps America's best-known labor arbitrator, Theodore W. Keel. Tuesday, Del's guest is the former governor of Michael DeSalle, who questions capital punishment. Does society have a right to kill? Wednesday, the editor of Liberator magazine, Dan Watts. Thursday, Del's guest discusses the rising rate of suicides and their prevention, Dr. C.J. Frederick. And Friday, the president of San Francisco State College, Dr. S.I. Hayakawa. All this next week on Night Call. Ask your own questions direct. Speak for yourself collect from anywhere in North America to guest Yippie Abby Hoffman about the Yippie style of revolution. All Night Call collect from the East and Midwest on area code 212-749-3311. From the West on area code 212-749-4300. And from the New York area on 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
And we return to our guest, Abby Hoffman. We'll take our next call from Philadelphia. Mr. Norris is hearing Night Call over WHAT. Mr. Norris?
Yes.
Good evening, sir.
You are discussing about yippies in San Francisco, is that correct?
Not in San Francisco, but yippies in general.
Well, I believe that a yippie is a normal group in San Francisco as a hippie would be in the East, such as in New York, or in Philadelphia, or maybe in parts of Connecticut.
No, we're all gypsies. We move around.
Gypsies, you said?
Gypsies, yeah.
Well, a yippie is like a West Coast fad, and a hippie is an East Coast.
We started here in New York.
Well, see, Mr. Norris, you're giving your definition, and Mr. Hoffman is generally recognized as the leader of the yippies, so...
Well, yes, sir. Well, what I believe is that the Y and the H is a change in the communication media of getting from one extreme end of the country to another. They just change it from a Y to a H. So it's saying that in the West Coast, you don't say West and East. You say Los Angeles and New York. When they say yippee, hippie, what's the difference? A bippy and a...
Well, why do you believe that?
I believe it's... I heard someone else mention it, but I had written my notes down to talk about this before you said it.
Right, but I'm saying that Mr. Hoffman is recognized as the leader of the yippies, and he explained how it came about. Now, do you accept his definition?
Yes, I do.
I see.
You don't have to.
As far as the police in the West and the police in the East, the difference is basically... actually none. It's just in the West, you are, I believe, more free to do certain things that you cannot do in the overly populated Eastern states.
Is that true, Mr. Hoffman?
Well,
or do you, I don't mean if it's true, but do you agree with that, that premise?
There is a difference in the police. The police in the, we'll take California, are made out of chrome. Here, they're just
what
made
did you
out
say?
Of fat.
What? I don't understand your...
Chrome. They're like a part of their...
I don't understand
their,
your...
the police are an extension
of their automobile. I'm an American Negro, and
wait,
I don't understand the Yippie slang language.
Well no. They're part of their automobile. They move around in automobiles, and they never get out.
Oh, you call the automobile a chrome. Well, the way I had this, I said how they traveled in buses, which were old school buses or old bought buses, which were fixed up and repaired to look reputable and livable in, like a big group. And they would travel and converge on the main event of the country and express their views in a way of their own, which sometimes is outlandish, and at times becomes hostile, and police do the next best thing to prevent dangers to themselves and others that may be around them.
Well, Mr. Norris, you are presenting a theory or an idea of what you believe in or what you have learned.
That is true.
And all of us, I think, have read the press, we watch television, we listen. Now, just a moment. Now, if you call on the show, now let me explain a couple of things. Now, we invited Mr. Hoffman in so that he could give us what we hope will be an authentic and official standing of the Yippies and their description, as well as their philosophy and how they work. But you haven't allowed Mr. Hoffman to answer anything. You've merely given us your definition of what you think a Yippie and a hippie is. Now, if you're calling into the guest who is, I don't know if he accepts the position of being the head of the Yippies or being the spokesman or being the titular head or whatever it is, he is here as someone who can officially tell us what the Yippies are. I beg your pardon? I beg your pardon? Well, I would assume so, right. So if you're calling in, I would prefer that you would ask the question and then see if we can have some kind of exchange, all right?
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Well, the attire. What do you feel that the attire and the of a Yippie is? Their basic attire.
It's an expression of how we feel. Although it seems like a superficial aspect, it's an important aspect. I mean, it's a lot like what's going on in the black community, you know, with dashikis and what's an afro? It, you know, it's another long hair. And I think young blacks are searching for their new identity and their roots in Africa. Well, we as whites, as young whites, are trying to search out a new identity too, one that's more human and allows us to live in a state of community and not in, like, this warlike, brutal society that we have.
Well, may I say what I
so it's
what
at the
I
same
think.
Time, it's a fun thing, you yeah. know, our costumes and wearing long hair, and it's,
I don't believe it's
an affront.
I don't believe it's a front or a costume. I don't believe that. Not the way from what I've learned about a Yippie. Could I say what I think about the attire?
Sure.
I believe that the attire is basically the same styles as the East, as it would be in New York, and the West, as it would be in San Francisco, but it is just the style of clothes. It's always the long hair, the round glasses.
Well,
but it's the style of clothes in an Eastern city such as New York, and in a far Western city such as San Francisco, where I thought the Yippies originated.
Go ahead, Abby.
It's kind of tough because, see, we're trying to put labels and fasten one image on something that's all spread out and wiggly. It's a phenomenon that's not only happening in this country, but in every country in the world right now.
You mean it's something that's loose, the image?
Well, people want to hang looser. They don't want to, be tied into a structure, into a 9-to-5, wall-to-wall head structure. They want to hang loose.
Yes, sir. Or you said something.
And smile a little.
Yes, but I believe in that too. You said something about the police and the event in Weaver Central Park, Mr. Shields.
Wait, yo.
They were pulling the hands off of the crowd.
No, it was. They went to Grand Central Park.
Grand Central Park.
Right. I mean, the Grand Central Station, excuse me. Grand Central Station, right. I think it is. And we thank you, sir.
I'm not finished. No.
Well, I don't want to be discourteous, but I've given you about 6 minutes. You know, this is a nationwide show.
About the police. What he said about the police.
Go ahead, sir. Thank you very much, sir.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. This time out to Seattle, Washington, Mr. Hendricks is hearing Night Call over KUOW-FM. Mr. Hendricks?
Yes.
How are you, sir?
I'd like to have a little more information or to have the guest to tell me a little more about himself. He is the founder of the hippie movement, but other than that, how old is he? And what did he do before he founded the hippie movement? And what is he doing now as far as... any type of work or occupation or whatever?
I'll never work again. We're for full unemployment. Let's see. Well, I don't know. When you get into personal, personal autobiographies, you can pick out anything. I was, what becomes relevant. I know how to shoot pool. What? I was going to college and graduate school out there, University of California, and something happened very strange. This was in 1960, and there was a guy out there, Carl Chessman. Maybe you remember that. You remember that?
Carl Chessman?
Yeah. He was a guy who had... been accused of rape, I think it was, and he'd been on death row. He had been sentenced to death, and he had like 11 stays of execution, was on death row something like 10 years. And I was sort of against capital punishment then, and we went down to San Quentin and stood outside in this vigil for him and, said, gee, this isn't the way to do it. Just put this guy out. He'd written a few books and everything while he was in prison. There seemed to be a better way. And there was Governor Pat Brown, a good old liberal, saying, well, I'm against capital punishment, but in this case, my hands are tied. And some guy came out and read a piece of paper, said, we just gassed him. He's dead. And we went home, like, feeling very helpless and like something was wrong. And how could a governor say that, well... he was against capital punishment, but... And then, slowly, I started learning that there were a lot of people in power saying, but, we're with you, but. I mean, you hear that 100 times a day. And then I went south, And I worked in Mississippi and Alabama and Georgia, and with the civil rights movement with SNCC, and got involved in a project called Poor People's Corporation, Mississippi, where we're developing craft cooperatives where the people there, former sharecroppers, were owning their own businesses and having a say in it for the first time, and came to New York to set up some outlets for the goods that were made there, the crafts. And then I got on the Lower East Side, and I start to see all these young white kids like myself running away from home and coming down there saying, we don't want it anymore. We don't want it out there. And I said, yeah, there's something going on here. There's something that we can build here, something we've got to make a new world relevant to these kids and to myself. I mean, I'm a runaway too. And I guess that was it. That, you know, just did that. And I went to the Pentagon. I was involved in the anti-war movement, you know, and you write all your letters first, and, you know, you go see your congressman, and you're like 42nd in line, you know, and he says, well, I'm with you. I'm with you. It's a terrible war, you know. And it was that whole process of people always being with you. You know, I was part of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Challenge in 1964 in Atlantic City. And we went out there and sang, we shall overcome, and all the congressmen would come out, we're with you. Yes, this is right. Sure, they're a bunch of racists in that state. They ought to be out, you know? But when the word went out from the boss, it was, you know, business as usual. And it was the whole process of these things, you know, that made me, I guess, more alienated than maybe you are from the political system and the economic system in this country, and more determined to change it.
Does that answer your question, Mr. Hendricks?
Well, yes, but other than that, you honestly believe that you're using the right approach?
Sure. I mean, you know, you do, there's no way to, there is no model for what we want to do. We can't look back in history and say, oh yeah, there was this group there and they went this, and then the next day they did this. This is, we're living in like a very new era, and we're trying to, we envision a society in 20 or 30 years, you know, that's quite different from this one, and we're just trying to speed up the process.
We
see are going to have to come inevitably, or this society is going to.
You think the lowering is going down the drain would help your movement, or your?
What was your question, sir?
Lowering the vote, the idea of lowering the voting age to 18. Do you?
Why not 10?
Well, why not 10?
Why not limit it at 30?
I'm beginning to think they should raise it to 25.
Well,
Mr. Hendricks, I want to thank you for calling. Mr. Hoffman, I'm going to ask you to respond after station identification. Thank you so much for calling, sir. This is Night Call in New York. We'll return to our guest, Abby Hoffman, following station identification.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Abby Hoffman after station identification. Monday night on Night Call, labor disputes. Does arbitration work? With Del Shields and his guest, nationally known labor strike mediator, Theodore W. Keel. Several years ago, Mr. Keel predicted labor relations would improve. Yet this year, many Americans would say Keel was wrong. During the last year, Americans have seen industrial strikes, steel strikes, dock strikes, and transportation strikes, which have presented major threats to the American economy. During the last year, Americans have seen public service strikes like never before. School strikes, hospital strikes, garbage strikes, touching and biting the American at his own front door. What do the unions want? Is it possible to satisfy labor? Are strikes becoming an annual affair like the renewal of contracts? Is labor too powerful? Does arbitration really work? Should the federal government regulate labor relations? Labor Disputes, Does Arbitration Work? With Del Shields and his guest, labor mediator Theodore W. Keel, Monday night on Night Call. Ask your own questions direct. Speak for yourself collect from anywhere in North America to guest Yippie Abby Hoffman about the Yippie style of revolution. All Night Call collect from the East and Midwest on area code 212-749-3311. from the West on area code 212-749-4300. And from the New York area on 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
And this time out to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, Mr. Devlin is hearing Night Caller for WHP. Mr. Devlin?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, sir.
Good evening. Well, Abby, you probably were wealthy or had some wealth behind you. And now you're sure to have it. Since you've written one book, you're going to write another.
Well,
now, your followers, there's probably some of them that are...
I should mention that I've given away over 1,000 copies of the book down here.
That's all right. I guess you can afford it.
I don't have a bank account.
It'll help, see? that'll help your propaganda. But what happens to these others who don't have any money? Who supports them, and what is there in the future for them? Can't you see they're heading for Nowheresville?
Who's Nowheresville?
You start a trend here in America, and the kids are going headlong, even though they don't contribute anything to your movement. They're going around with their hair down. They don't bathe. Their hair is unkempt. They're uncouth. Going around barefoot. They don't bathe. And their clothes are makeshift. You wonder where they go at night. Will they climb under rocks, or where they go? Now, couldn't you go about this thing a different way? Get if you really believe in this, instead of just having a fun thing out of it, why wouldn't you get into politics and get some of your people elected to office and do something to further whatever your goals are? It seems to me it's nothing but a revolution against our American institutions. And,
you get $30 million?
And you just smile, laugh away. You say, why not make the voting age 10 years of age? That's irresponsible. What happens to these young men who don't have any money? Who supports them?
They steal.
That's a big deal. Who supports them?
They learn how to survive. Maybe you'll support us.
You'll be out again, and they're just going from one prison to another, or going from one park to another. But where will they be 5, 10 years from now? What is their future? Won't they wind up in Nowheresville? And you will have your gold, and anybody that's, your colleagues or some of your close buddies will share it with you. But the thousands of you led headlong down this path of destruction, what will they have to show?
Well, I think we're going down the path of hope. I think following this political system and this economic system is going down the path of destruction. You see, there's something essentially evil about some people having millions of dollars and some people going hungry in the same country. There's something basically evil about that, something that really, that rots your insides and that gives you ulcers and makes you bite your fingernails when you... Watch
your fingernails up there, all right. I bet you don't have any ulcers either.
Say things like you're saying, like, what's this coming to? Oh, this is terrible. I better go play golf. I better drink another martini.
Do you think you're going to... Listen, you know that the most of people don't have...
We're filled with hope. We're not filled with visions of destruction. We're filled with visions of hope. We're filled with visions of... we're going to win this struggle.
Don't you believe in honest labor?
Huh?
Don't you believe in honest labor?
Well,
working for a wage.
Believe in it in what way? That a lot of people do it?
Earn your bread by the sweat of your brow.
That's a good idea.
But I don't mean that.
Mr. Devlin. Mr. Devlin. Mr. Devlin. Mr. Devlin and Abby. Mr. Devlin.
You won't, man.
Abby, just a moment. Let's see if we can't get some area of exchange here. First. One of the things that seems to frustrate most people about the Yippie movement is the fact that they do not like the method of programming your protest. Now, you mentioned to an earlier caller that the writing of the letters and the meeting of the congressman and standing in line and finally meeting the congressman face to face, and the congressman says he's with you. There are many people who say that they're with you, but... Now, are you saying to us that the areas that are open for... protest for a legitimate change are closed to us? Is this what you're saying?
Well,
there are minor reform elements, victories that can be won, but they're just like reformist, and they'll never. It's always like a patchwork. You know, it's just like going about it, putting on band-aids. For example, and we're involved in these. For example, we're just working with some doctors at a hospital here in New York, and the doctors were really upset that people were getting charged $16 just to come to an emergency clinic, you know, and they might be told, like, there's nothing the matter with them or have a band-aid, you know. Really exorbitant cost of medicine in this country. It's the only country in the world that doesn't have a free medical program. And they wanted to do something about it, and they were locked into this heavy hospital administration where if they stepped out of line, they would get smashed, they would get suspended, which would mean they couldn't practice medicine in any of the major hospitals in this country. So there were like three of them that were willing to take like a fairly militant stand, you know, by giving their patients notes telling them not to pay the bills. And they got suspended, they were ordered suspended. But lo and behold, the administration found out that there were another 30 physicians, you see, that were ready to quit if they were suspended, and the administration backed down and held off, and then they got in touch with other doctors, and that fee got lowered from $16 to $2 just this week. And, you know, that was like a step in the right direction, you know, $16 to $2, pretty soon it'll be zero, which is what they're aiming for. So it can be like those small kind of victories, but to talk in terms of like...
But are those victories important?
Well, they're important for the people who are paying that bill, sure. They're important for them, yeah. But you know, and it's a pecking away. But to talk in terms of like forming a political party and running, you know, in a national election is what I consider to be, you know, insane, frivolous talk. That's not going to happen.
Yes, they were.
Nixon spent $30 million becoming president, and a lot before the primary. I mean, our political system is one in which you get the choice of the lesser of two evils. You never, like, vote for who you really dig. Maybe the people who put up Wallace, they got a chance, you know? They voted for who they really liked. And, you know, but as far as Democrats and Republicans go, it's a lock. I mean, it's a closed system, and battles have to be won locally.
How about the independent voters?
Well, what about them?
Well, are they Democrats or Republicans or are they Wallace?
They always follow, look...
You can't put labels on people and say that makes them something good or bad.
Hmm?
You can't put a label on a voter, either Republican, a Democrat, or Independent, or a Wallace voter, and say they're good or bad.
I'm not saying that, but I'm saying that...
Well, you said that you inferred that Republicans and Democrats weren't...
The system allows for very little choice.
I see.
The system allows for very little choice.
What you did there as far as reducing that fee, your movement has a certain nuisance value. It's like a form of bribery to get you going, see, to move you along someplace else to get off their back. And your movement is like a pillow full of feathers that's cut loose in the wind and never gets anywhere.
Well,
can't bring it back at all. These kids are going headlong along with these feathers.
Mr. Devlin?
Humphrey says that we're responsible for him losing the election, and that's good.
Mr. Devlin, thank you for calling, sir. Mr. Hoffman, thank you so much for being our guest tonight on Night Call. This is Del Shields in New York. Good night and peace.
Night Call, the first and only nationwide listener call-in show on vital issues. Monday night, same time, same station, labor disputes. Does arbitration work? With Del Shields and his guest, Theodore Keel. Listen Monday night, discuss freely and responsibly your own personal opinions. Speak for yourself on Night Call. Produced by the United Methodist Church, presented with National Council of Churches, National Catholic Office for Radio and Television, American Jewish Committee, and Urban Coalition.